if you're doing a practice which is kind of accepting the way things are, then it's obviously very portable. All right? But if you don't get any focus, your mind can just be wandering all over the place. I think one is always trying to find some way of focusing the mind, but also keeping the mind quite open to the way things are. Because you can, in meditation, you can build up very refined states of peace, which are really constructed things, which require a lot of time and effort, and they can be fruitful for insight. But sometimes the people maybe mistake that experience of peace for a kind of result you're trying to get, and then ordinary life seems such a drag, just being with whoever. I think the most extreme experience I had of that, I saw when we were living, we had the use of a retreat center in Oxford way back in 78, I think. And there was an Asian woman who was a very, very good meditator. She could really, really concentrate, tremendous powers of concentration. And she actually owned the retreat center. And so she would do retreats with the various teachers that were coming through there, and there were Ajahn Chah was there, Mahasi Sayadaw, Ajahn Sumedho. Had some very great teachers came through. Thongpalu Sayadaw. I wasn't teaching that, I was younger. But she told me she got so concentrated that when she went back, because she lived on the site in a big house, when she went back and had dinner with her family, she had three daughters and the husband, the sound of the clack of the cutlery got her annoyed. And I thought, is that what we're doing? Right? Is that what the Buddha was suggesting? But she got, because she became so refined and so ethereal in her refinement, that coarseness became for her something that brought aversion. So refinement is very, very good if it leads to insight. But if it's refinement is attachment, then its opposite will be bothersome, to say the least. So this kind of way I'm suggesting of awakening to the way things are, sati sampajanya, is really knowing the way things are, I think that's actually very, very profound, because to do that you do have to stop. You have to enter into the present moment. For me to hear sound and really hear it, just to know the way it is, one has to stop thinking. So like last night sitting, listening to the mourning dove. Isn't that neat? How it kind of puts itself to sleep? It just does this little song, ooh, ooh, and it's gone. We could all fall asleep like that. So I just use that. This is a sweet sound. This is what sweet sound sounds like, and just being with that. That's very, very ordinary. It's also, you have to be there. You have to be present. You have to stop thinking. So it might not seem like much, but I think there's a kind of accumulation of power from that. And I think there's also a tremendous flexibility in that. So, as I was saying earlier, when my mother died, I had about 2.5 months of really terrible, terrible emotional states. Not that I was, it wasn't like, I don't even know what grieving is. I was just like very, very, very tired. And it only made sense. It only made sense. So I had memories because I was with her when she died and I was nursing her and she's my mom and we were close and so on. So the memories of her pain and dying isn't a pretty number. And then my incompetence in nursing and all kinds of things came up. So then the result of that was like exhaustion and a lot of negativity. But how else could it be? oh great, mom's dead. It's just life, isn't that way? So sometimes life demands of us something we really need to extend ourselves, and there are consequences to that exhaustion. But this practice, this practice takes you through that. I didn't like when very difficult states of mind come up, we say, well, then the practice clicks in. It's really what I've what I've done beforehand in terms of meditation practice and awareness, which then starts to operate or operates there, because that's the habit. So just the capacity to really have terrible memories of someone dying, and allowing that just to be it as it is, just a kind of terrible, just painful or averse and depression, but not depression is a too strong a word, but just bloody awful for 2.5 months. And but that's okay, because if the underlying sense of this is the way it is now, and you have a sense that, and it will change, its nature is to change, and that's not my real home, that those negative emotions are not my real home, then that kind of underlying insight, sati sampajanya, that understanding wisdom, takes you through that. You might not be doing it kind of consciously, but it takes you through that, and then you get through it. So I got through that in about 2.5 months, and then the whole thing lifted. I had a lovely dream about my mom, and so it all kind of, and I've had really, you know, really, for the most part, just beautiful, beautiful karma from having done that. But every day, every day I get a memory of her dying, but now it doesn't have the emotional impact. It's not like a horror thing anymore. It's just a very strong memory. It's just a memory. That's all it is, and that's the way the mind works. So the sense of this practice of just like, you wouldn't think like listening to the mourning dove is all that significant. But if it's not just about entertainment by the mourning dove, but it is this profound awakening just the way it is, then that clicks in those difficult times, those complicated times when you just have to bear witness to difficult things. You have to be very patient. So for me, I look for ways of grounding myself in the present moment. So like I was talking yesterday about the breath, and the breath is kind of infinite possibilities of development. The breath is always there until you're dead. And then it doesn't matter. But you can I think it's good to learn some pranayama, ujjayi pranayama, to learn how to use the breath as an energizing tool. Because we are energy beings, we have energy. So quite often meditators suffer from restlessness and dullness. And some of that dullness is just exhaustion from life, and you get through it in day 3 or 4, you're okay or whatever. But sometimes exhaustion is just a habit. And we certainly see that in monastic life, where monks who have been at it long enough, they should know better, as it were, and you know they're not tired, but just got into a habit of dulling out. So learning about the energy system and the breath is very good for that. Pranayama or deep breathing, or just learning how, the calmness at the end of the out-breath. If your mind goes to past and future a lot, you can do counting. That's most of us maybe started with that. I don't know. I think I did way back. You count one at the end of each out-breath, and you get to maybe 3 breaths, and then you're already in Thailand, and you're becoming whatever, whoops, and then you start at one again. And it's such ABC stuff, but it's actually very powerful, because it just kind of forces you to come into the present moment. Counting breaths, feeling the breath, deepening the breath. So you don't have to just be passive with it. And then you find a comfortable breath, and then if you're doing breathing, then it usually gets more and more refined. Then you might focus on one part of the breath. You might, some teachers teach the belly. Ajahn Chah said, focus at the nose. I like to focus at the heart. And then people actually argue about that. Amazes me. So it's a kind of the very experimenting with something like the breath and the breath body is an activity, and that activity keeps you in the present moment. Learning how to like as the yoga schools talk more about learning to breathe with the whole body, prana going through the whole body. These are very, very good things to explore. And the exploration just keeps you in the present moment. So what you do is you use interest, and then the interest connects to the body in some way, and then through that experimentation, you discover how to use breathing as a way of centering yourself or energizing yourself or calming yourself. And that experience becomes part of your intuitive understanding of meditation. And it's a craft. It really is a craft. Like any craft, it's something you do, you experiment, and you get good results and bad results, good results and bad results. But you keep watching cause and effect, and you become adept. You become skilled, like a potter or a weaver or a good chef or whatever. So that's not so much a technique as an engagement with your own consciousness, with your own body. So I would recommend that. It's a good standard, the breathing. So if I get like I use my spine a lot, and then I use the breathing through the spine a lot. If I'm tired, I try to do some kind of minimal pranayama, things like that. And just over the years, I've figured out a way where that's really helpful for me. Yeah, I like to do, personally, I find a way of grounding, also being present in the moment, is with the attitude I have to the present moment. And for me, kindness is a very important part of Buddhist lifestyle and Buddhist meditation. And there are so many references to aspects of the heart in the texts, from the Brahma Viharas, which we chanted, kindness, or kind of wishing everyone well-being, wishing people freedom from suffering, compassion, uplift, gladness, equanimity, generosity, kind of sensitivity in speech, gratitude. You know, there's so many ways that we find that in the texts and Buddhist teachings. And that's very much part of the method. It's not the goal. You know, compassion isn't the goal of Buddhism, it's the method. Because if it was the goal, then what do you do when you're not compassionate? You feel guilty. And you try to get compassion. So compassion is a method. And I think that's a kind of important distinction. Because even if you don't feel compassionate, you say, well, this is a feeling of non-compassion. And you're okay. Whereas if you get an ideal that all Buddhists are compassionate 110% of the time to all people at all instances, you're finished. You just, you can't do it. It's impossible. But when you can, and you've got the space in the mind, with the mind, like when I was going through this exhaustion with my mother, I didn't have much room for compassion. And basically, I said, if someone asked me something modest, I said, get lost. Because it was my time, to say things like, I didn't say that, but that's what my mind said. But it was, it wasn't a time to say, may all beings be well. I said, no, I'm going to be depressed, thank you. You have to be with this now. It's not a time to... And yet, within that, there was one person that came who hadn't been to the monastery, and I couldn't escape. So then I just dropped all that, and then I put out a bit of charm and said, welcome and all that. And they were fine, and then went back and got depressed again. Because you can do that. We have that. We have that capacity. We do that with kindness. So anyway, like this morning, as a practice, as a kind of stimulation of the heart, I just kind of tried to remember all the different names of friends in this room and, wished you well. I hope you all felt it, of course. And then I'd run out of names, and then I just did a general wash. And then another name would pop up. Oh, yeah. That was a great morning. So you can have fun, It's really lovely, And so it can be, rather than kind of, I have to manufacture some love. I need to kind of, which then becomes this desire or greed for some kind of ethereal loving feeling. Whereas just the thought of, Patrick, may you be well. Janice, may you be well. Don, may you be well. Just kind of going through that. It's just lovely. And it's grounding yourself in the present moment. But you're also doing something. You're active and you're creating something wholesome in the mind because you've got the space to do that. And sometimes you don't. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you're processing some deep sense of grief or some deep sense of betrayal or some physical illness, which is very, very challenging, and you just have to be with that. That's the way it feels. But these attitudes that we develop when we have a bit more spaciousness, then they become the foundation for dealing with those the more difficult things. So compassion, mindfulness and clear comprehension, satisampajanya, these things become the foundation of our attitudes to life, don't they? You know, that's what clicks in, because that's what the mind is used to doing. So then, like I found with the heart practices, I find breathing here. I'll do that with you. You know I like to do that. But I just found exploring this heart chakra has been very, very fruitful, very helpful. And then using the breath in here and using imagery which reminds me of feelings of compassion, and just repeating that pattern, very simple pattern, is both calming and very heart-opening, and to stimulate that area. And then that becomes a way that my consciousness then likes to go there more now. So there's still that analytical part in me. So there's, you know, like all of you, I have an inner committee. You have an inner committee that, like, so I get one of my inner committee members is the critic of my talks. So I wake up in the morning, there's a critic, well, very dumb, oh, that was, you know, it was too much of that, and that was too fast, it was too slow, too many jokes, not enough jokes. You know, it's just kind of, okay, there you are. So, you know, we have these beings that inhabit consciousness, and so that used to be very, very strong, but now I say, oh, how you doing? And then I go down to the heart. Now, can it, you know, consciousness from the heart is a whole different experience than consciousness as a kind of critical analysis of the way things are. And that's, I think, most of us have probably been trained in that way, and we use that, you need to use that. But it can become a bad habit, where the mind is always in some kind of critical, analytical, intellectual mode. And Buddhism, which is left as an idea, is not liberation. You know, it's just a neat idea. So, that's what I found, like body awareness with the breath, and then body awareness of our emotional makeup. So what does fear feel like at the heart? Or what does aversion feel like in the chest or the heart or the guts? What is that like? So then there's still mindfulness of the way things are, but now it's kind of an inquiry into, like, say, a negative emotion through the body rather than through thought. And I found that much more profitable, because the tendency I had with the thinking mind was then to always just continually reinvigorate the reality of the emotion through thinking that, or just analyzing or thinking it all the time. So I didn't tend to release it. Whereas when I just kind of let it be in the body and say, well, whatever, this is the way it feels, then it tends to come to an end, tends to cease. Whereas with thought, I found I just tended to reinforce its reality. So then I found that thought, if you take thought and say, yeah, what's that emotion like here? Or what's it like in the belly or in the shoulders? And then there's still investigation. I'm not repressing it or trying to get rid of it. But now it's known as an energetic form. And that's much more objective. Whereas the thinking mind, I found I was very subjective. Like, oh, what am I doing? Why is this like that? And this sort of inner arguing and inner discussion, which to me seemed endless. It just went on and on and on. So I think, a lot in the text is a lot about body awareness. If you take like body sweeping, that's a new technique you find, or the breath, or our emotional body, our energy body. There's a lot of understanding in the body. And the body is a very, very, it's a very direct experience. It's not mediated by thought. It's very direct, where thought can be off in its analysis, or sometimes it's on, but sometimes it's not. There's much encouragement text about body awareness. So these attitudes of compassion or kindness, these are foundational attitudes, because they give you heart. To keep going, you know, they really do. So, like, beginning a meditation with gratitude is a lovely way to start. Just I do a lot of my meditations. Say, Mom, maybe well and happy. Now, I don't know how that works. People say, yeah, your mom's died. Yeah, I guess. But I just do it as an emotional thing, right? Rather than as a philosophical or some kind of description of rebirth or something like that. Or I'll oftentimes think of my teachers, Ajahn Sumedho, Ajahn Chah, and express gratitude. An entry into meditation from that heart space is already a sense of non-desire. And non-desire is very important in understanding that in Buddhism. It's non-desire. It's this way now. Because when we awaken to the way things are, that's non-desire. I don't want anything from this. It's just the way it is. And it's in non-desire that you find your real home. So when I'm with something which is, say, emotionally difficult, to abide with it with non-desire, this is just the way it is now, is difficult. I want to run away from it. I want to understand it. I think there's something wrong with me. Blah, 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 blah. And then non-desire feels this way. It's just this way. So if I do that in the ordinary, then the extraordinary, you know, there'll be the equipment there to deal with that. So body awareness, heart practices, being with the breath, these are very, very simple things, very profound things, but part of the craft of the contemplative in a Buddhist tradition. One quick story. So I was doing Peterborough ones have heard this one, I think. Anyway, I was doing a retreat in, where was I? I was in Wellington last February. And I've been doing reunion retreats for the last 2 years. I do one in Latvia in June. I did one in England. Yeah, this is great, great fun. Anyway, this is in Wellington, so I hadn't been back there for over a decade. With 40 people. It was around Friday, Saturday. So I'd done the interviews, and then people were asking for individual interviews, and a woman came, and she was kind of beating around the bush. I said, what's the problem? You know, where's she at? And then she said, your mother's a really feisty lady. Yeah? I didn't know this woman from Adam, right? Or from Eve, sorry. So then she tells me that my mom's been following around on the walking tracks. I said, oh, come on. Yeah, because I had had two people telling me about my mother's afterlife experience, and to me they seemed like huge egos, so I didn't believe them. But this woman was something curiously authentic about her. So I said, yeah, she's been following me around. There's a big walking path in the monastery in New Zealand. Yeah, she's very, very feisty. And she just wanted me to pass a message. I said, okay, right. What am I going to do with this? And she said, she finally gets it. I said, huh? She said, she never understood why I was a monk, but now she gets it. I said, it was such a different way to, you know, it was like she wasn't reborn as Queen of Sheba or something like that, right? It was just this kind of, that's interesting. And then the second one was, she's enjoying the travel. Because then I went to Australia, Laos, and China. So what do you do with that? I don't know. But I don't know, I just take it, say, yeah, why not? I don't know. I haven't got a psychic bone in my body. I don't know, but... And then, of course, then I started to kind of observe this woman in the crowd. and in the closing, when I made the closing talk on the Sunday, I was kind of talking, I was looking at her, and she was kind of like, she was talking to my mother or something. But, she seemed like really kind of authentic person and sincere. So whatever it was, it was beautiful, you know, it's beautiful for the heart. Because my mom, you know, she loved me, but she couldn't quite figure out why anyone would wear this clothing. Aya Nimala in Satisaraniya, she said when she was a laywoman, she reminded me of this story. Mom said, I'll give you an imitation of a monk. So here's my mom, she's 85 plus. She gets up, you know, she kind of, you know, she's got bad osteoporosis, and she starts doing this. Now, we monks have this, right? Because these things fall off all the time. And she starts, oh, it's so funny. So anyway, she was more elegant than this outfit. She thought I should wear a Zen outfit. And then she tried to read that little book of mine many times, but she just was too sleepy. You know, she was under a lot of OxyContin and those kinds of medications. She had a lot of pain, so she never really got to read that. The one thing that she said, she always said, what comes goes. She said, that really helps me. Well, that's pretty good. That's all right. But then this woman said, now she gets it. I thought, oh. Anyway. So there's memory, you know, there's memory, but there's the tone of memory too. That you can remember someone that you love and care for, and then you can drop the memory, you can drop the narrative. And I think this is important in a meditative practice, that we learn how to recollect. And recollection is a strong word in our tradition. You recollect something, but you don't necessarily go to the narrative. So in the meditation of the heart, that's what I try to do. I try to recollect the feeling of a person. So if I were to take Ajahn Sumedho, because he's been so very, very formative in my own practice and so kind and generous to me, that when I raise his image and name in consciousness, immediately there's a powerful feeling of gratitude. And then I feel that in the heart, use his name a few times, and then drop the name, drop the narrative, and then the heart's open. You enter, because we have that. It's just kind of recollecting it. And then it's no longer a verbal exercise, it's very much a visceral exercise of just making that stronger. And then, of course, the idea is then you reinvigorate that with another image, another person, and then just get more and more awareness of the heart feeling. That's the way I've always... Well, that's the way I find this practice very good. And then the more awareness can abide from here, live from here, just function from here, then when there's something negative, such as aversion to someone or self-criticism or self-judgment in a harsh kind of way, then that's felt here. And more you process it as a visceral experience rather than as just an argument with yourself or someone else. So it's very, very, very helpful. Helpful way to practice. So maybe we could do that. Stretch your legs a bit and we'll do some of that practice.